Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
From the Missouri School of Journalism, welcome to Global Journalist. I'm David Reed. The Syrian dictator's crackdown on opposition forces is escalating. 6 straight days of heavy bombardment has left hundreds dead in homes. As rocket and mortar fire rained down on neighborhoods in the country's third largest city, Russia and China vetoed a United Nations resolution calling for President Bashar Assad to cede power. The UN estimates that more than 5,400 people have been killed in Syria since the protests against Assad began 11 months ago. But getting an accurate account of what's happening on the ground is impossible. That's because the Syrian government has cracked down on local journalists and denied access to most foreign reporters. International observers have left the country, fearing for their lives. The International Press Institute has been urging the Syrian government to end the media blockade, and Human Rights Watch has been tracking attacks on civilians by using a network of sources. Joining us today to talk about the developments in Syria are Ule Solvang and Anthony Mills. Welcome to the show. Ule is an emergencies researcher at Human Rights Watch and co-author of a recent in-depth report on human rights abuses in Syria. Anthony Mills is the Press Freedom and Communications Manager for the International Press Institute. Anthony, video smuggled out of Syria shows unarmed demonstrators being shot down. Correspondents who have managed to sneak into Syria report that many civilians are being killed by the bombings. But what are Syrians hearing on the state-controlled media about what's happening?
Well, what Syrians are hearing on the state-controlled media is that this is all the work of, quote, armed gangs and or militants of various stripes. There's absolutely no mention of unarmed civilians being killed by Syrian government forces or the Syrian army. On the contrary, this is all sort of the finger is being pointed at thugs, criminals, armed elements. And then as well, we're seeing something on Syrian state media, which is kind of similar to what was on state media in other countries, other Arab countries where there were the uprisings, which is the suggestion that there's a foreign hand playing a role here. This is some sort of a conspiracy targeting Syria, but absolutely no mention of unarmed civilians being killed by their own government.
Right. And Ule, Human Rights Watch put out a report today, I believe. What are the highlights of that report about what's happening in Syria?
Well, as you mentioned in your introduction, since last Friday, the Syrian military forces have launched large-scale attacks on several populated areas in Syria, and one of the places that has been worst affected is the city of Homs, which is the third largest city in Syria and has been a bit of a center for the anti-government demonstrations. For 5 or 6 days now, the government forces have been basically surrounding these populated areas, preventing people from leaving, preventing people from entering this area. They have cut electricity, they have blocked food delivery and medicine delivery into the area, and they have been shelling the area with no concern in terms of how many civilians are being killed. And it is incredibly hard to get accurate information out about what is going on, but we believe that at this point more than 300 people have been killed in less than a week from this shelling.
And Anthony, what's the environment like for journalists in Syria?
It's extremely difficult, even at the best of times. Before joining the International Press Institute, I was actually a correspondent based in Beirut for a number of years and reporting for CNN, among others, and also reported from Syria. And I can tell you that even before this uprising erupted, there was no independent media to speak of in Syria. It's an utterly closed society, it's a police state. And so even before this uprising, there was no real independent media. Following the start of the uprising, things got even worse, particularly with respect, though, to what we call citizen journalists. I mean, people who are not professional journalists, per se, but are on the ground and have access to various devices and social media and are getting out this vital information from the places like Homs about what is going on. The challenge, though, is verifying this information, precisely because it is not being brought out by professional independent journalists, but by citizen journalists, activists, and so on. So it's a real challenge. And we see mainstream international media organizations and others relying on this footage, albeit with the caveat that it can't be verified. For those handful of foreign journalists who have either been allowed in on government visas, or have been smuggled in, such as the BBC correspondent who recently spent a number of days in Homs, things are extremely dangerous. We saw the French TV correspondent who was killed in an attack in an explosion in Syria just a couple of weeks ago or so. A lot of uncertainty surrounding who may have been responsible for that, and we've seen other journalists threatened and dealt with in an extremely harsh manner. One only needs to imagine what would happen to a journalist, even a foreign journalist, if they were caught inside Syria without a government visa.
Right. And Uli, how does this compare with what you're hearing and finding out in Syria?
I think it is absolutely accurate. I think it is extremely difficult and dangerous at this point to get information verified. There are ways of doing that, and we always try to verify to the extent possible information before we put it out, and there's different ways. We try to track down the people who have filmed the incident in question and uploaded it on YouTube, or we try to talk to other witnesses who were present at the scene of the incident there. It is becoming extremely difficult, particularly when the army is launching large-scale military operations, because as a rule, they usually cut electricity, they cut phone lines as well. So getting through to people is extremely difficult, and the only people in many cases we're able to reach are those that have satellite phones. But in addition to that, I think one of the very important ways that we at least use to verify information is by going to the neighboring countries and talk to refugees, talk to defectors from the military, interview them at length, and in that way being able to verify some of the information that have come out on YouTube or on blogs or in other ways.
Yes, I noticed in your report you interview people separately, cross-reference details. What are some other ways that, and I know you've been using defectors from the army also to bolster the case that there are crimes against humanity here. Could you talk about the way you use these defectors from the army?
Well, I mean, there are different ways that we approach our research, and there are different ways in which we verify our research, and the methodology that we use on Syria is no different from the methodology that we use in many other countries. Most of the information that we collect is based on in-depth, detailed interviews with first-hand witnesses. And very often those are victims themselves, or they can be witnesses. What is really unique in many ways about the situation in Syria is that there is such a large number of defectors and defectors who have left the country that we can interview. And that has really given us a very detailed insight in terms of how the military and the security agencies are structured, where they are deployed, who are the commanders, who gave orders to do what. So a report that we put out in December was based on the interviews with more than 60 of these defectors, and in that report, we named more than 70 officers and commanders who we believed should be investigated for their role in the crackdown on demonstrators, violations that that we believe are crimes against humanity.
Right. Sounds like you're building a court case. How do you court your sources, and how do you ensure them that they will be safe if they return, or that their families are going to be safe?
Well, I think in all our research, and particularly in Syria, where we know that the security and intelligence agencies are so active, they have such a wide network and such a wide reach, and they're so brutal, the safety of witnesses and the people we speak to is really paramount for us. And that's something that really plays into the entire research process, from how we approach people. We always try to make sure that people have a choice whether they talk to us or not, so that, you know, they're not suddenly just, you know, finding themselves in a room with a bunch of foreigners and only then find out that it is, you know, this international human rights organization that they're supposed to speak with, to making sure that the information that we collect, that it's stored safely, that it is encrypted if it is on computers, and to the way that we publish the information, making sure that we, if people have requested anonymity, that we do not disclose any information about their identity, any other information that can help somebody identify who they are. And in Syria in particular, as a rule, particularly when we talk to victims, it's better to be safe than sorry. So in those cases, we have insisted on anonymity for all our victims.
Anthony, what do you see as being necessary for the situation to change, and for international monitors to come back, and possibly for the government to relent and allow correspondence in? Will it take just more international pressure, or what do you see is coming up next?
I think the situation in the case of Syria is one that is extremely complex because of the interconnectivity of Syria with the rest of the Middle East, and indeed in terms of allies and Russia and China vetoing any Security Council resolution. And so, unfortunately, I think there is the prospect of a continuation of the violence. In the meantime, the quandary remains the same, at least from a news gathering perspective. Even the BBC journalist who spent several days in Homs left Homs, and as I understand it, is now in Beirut, Lebanon, which is a far safer place to be right now. And so basically, independent news witnesses on the ground are virtually non-existent in Homs. One can only imagine the kind of environment that is existing there right now. Now, it is true, obviously, that we're seeing the emergence still of footage from inside Homs. But as I say, it is very difficult to verify the authenticity of that footage, although taken as a whole, it certainly paints a very, very stark picture.
Right. I
think it is true to say as well, the gentleman from Human Rights Watch was saying, that it is possible to build up a very strong picture from speaking to people who are believed to have witnessed the events that are unfolding inside Syria, who are maybe refugees or who are defectors, and whose independent accounts of what is happening there really kind of paint a very stark picture as well. But from a news gathering perspective, from a sort of a media perspective, it's not a complete replacement for actually having journalists on the ground. Unfortunately, shutting journalists out and creating a kind of a vacuum, or attempting to create a vacuum, is something that is not new in Syria. It is not new even throughout the other Arab countries in which we've seen uprisings. Wherever there are situations in which there are military operations, and particularly in situations where dictators are seeking to cling on to power, they attempt to create a complete kind of news shutdown. And there's an enormous challenge involved in countering that shutdown. I do believe that very courageous journalists, whether Syrian or other, will continue to try to document what is going on there independently. I think we will continue to see journalists being smuggled into Syria and trying to report independently from there. But it is an extremely dangerous thing to do. And I think, unfortunately, that the challenges will continue to grow.
And before I will ask you about your take on the international response, I want to remind everyone that you can view or listen to this program anytime by downloading our podcasts at globaljournalist.org. You can also find interesting articles, photos, and interviews related to today's program on our website. Please send us your questions or comments via globaljournalist@kbia.org or our Facebook page. So Ule, how would you characterize the international response, and what do you foresee as happening in the coming weeks?
Well, it's difficult because Russia and China's veto at the Security Council really has paralyzed the Security Council for the time being. But there are still, there are still options, and the international community definitely should not give up on this issue yet. There needs to be continued discussions at the Security Council. There needs to be continued pressure on Russia and on China. There is really a huge burden on Russia and China now because they have obstructed strong international action. They really need to show that they are capable of stopping Assad. And if they can't do so in a very short time period, they need to change their position and go back and allow Security Council to step in. At the same time, the General Assembly at the UN is another avenue where Syria can be discussed, where countries can take action, come together around resolutions. And we've also seen, of course, that the Arab League has played a very important role. And it is really important that both the Arab League, the EU, the U.S., Canada, and others who feel strongly about ending the violations in Syria, that they come together. There's been talk about a group of friends of Syria, that they continue the sanctions, that they expand the sanctions to the extent that they're believed to be effective, and that there's really continued strong pressure on Assad to stop these horrific violations.
Right. And would it help to have the Arab League is talking now about sending in international observers? How would that help the situation?
Well, I mean, it's one of many, many measures that can be taken. Having people, independent observers on the ground is never going to hurt. And to the extent that it is possible, I think it would be a good thing. What we saw with the observer mission when it was sent in back in December was that it was not, for all its good intentions, it was not properly prepared. There were some questions about the composition and the background and the qualifications of the observers. There were questions about whether it had the resources that it needed, et cetera. Keeping in mind that this has been the first observer mission like this deployed by the Arab League, it is perhaps not surprising. I think what is important now is that the Arab League has recognized that it might need some help. It has approached the UN, and the UN has promised support and help. But the biggest problem with the observer mission when it was launched in December was really that it was manipulated by the Syrian government.
Right.
And, of course, the government will try to do that again, and the extent to which such an observer mission will be successful or effective is dependent on whether they will be able to not let themselves be manipulated by the Syrian government to only go to the places, for example, that the Syrian government want them to go, but to actually go to the places where the violations occur.
And Anthony, does having this kind of observer mission, does that help provide cover to journalists? How do they work together?
Unfortunately, I have to say that I don't think it does. I do believe, of course, that having independent observers on the ground, as was just said, can't hurt per se. Unfortunately, though, I think that the view from the regime may very well be that this kind of buys some time. And indeed, I think what we're seeing here is a feeling that time is being bought. Time is being bought by all accounts, failed initial Arab observer mission, by a failed, indeed, I think two in total failed attempts to pass a resolution at the UN Security Council. And so in the interim, the atrocities continue. Even when the observers are there, I would argue that they're unlikely to be able to provide a great deal of cover to journalists, primarily as well because they tend to be taken to places which the government wants them to see, as opposed to the places that the government doesn't want them to see, and particularly in the areas where the atrocities are being committed and where journalists are likely to want to go, that's where the danger is greatest. It's worth bearing in mind as well that the French journalist from France 2, who was killed just a few weeks ago, was, as I understand it, until very shortly before he actually died, in the company of Syrian soldiers. He was there on a state-sanctioned visit to Syria, as I understand it. He had a visa. He was there with the full blessing, if you will, of the Syrian government and the Syrian state. And yet, even with that blessing, he ended up dead, starkly highlighting the threats faced by journalists, even when they are theoretically there with the blessing of the Syrian government and are among the very small number of foreign journalists allowed in. So I think that, unfortunately, for as long as this violence continues, for as long as these atrocities continue, and for as long as there is upheaval like this in Syria, an attempt to distort the image that is coming out, distort the information that is coming out, and intimidate, because that's what it is, intimidate journalists, whether they're Syrian or others, we're going to see a continued risk to journalists. And I fear that the situation will get worse before it gets better.
So What can the international community do, Anthony, to help journalists cover the country?
I think that there is the you address with that question the broader issue of the safety of journalists, which is something that that the International Press Institute seeks very strongly to promote, along with a whole number of other organizations, and that is that every country, every government, every state has an obligation to seek to ensure the safety of journalists, to respect the independence of journalists operating in conflict zones and elsewhere, and certainly to do their best to ensure that journalists are not targeted in attacks. Unfortunately, far too often, governments either turn a blind eye to attacks on journalists or actually actively seek to endanger journalists. What the international community can do, and unfortunately it's not always effective and not all institutions and organizations within the international community are dedicated enough to this, but what they should seek to be doing is putting very, very strong pressure on governments and countries that are seen to be violating the right of journalists to operate safely and independently. Through various bodies. In the case of Syria, I think that it is part of the overall effort to seek to hold people to account for crimes committed, to send the message that the international community and international organizations, whether they're NGOs or other institutions such as the United Nations Human Rights Council, that they're watching very carefully, that they're watching all violations very carefully and documenting them, and that there is no statute of limitations on serious crimes against humanity.
Yeah, but speaking of that, Ule, what's the Human Rights Watch strategy forward? Are they going to try to build a case against the Assad regime? And
we are going to continue to do our work, and which is to document these violations, to publish information about these violations, and then to try to end them. And of course, a lot of the information that we are collecting will hopefully someday be part of an investigation and prosecution of those who were responsible. Whether that takes place in domestic courts in Syria at some time in the future, or whether that, you know, whether the Security Council decides to refer Syria to the International Criminal Court, we don't know yet. But we are convinced, based on all the conflicts that we worked in, that ending impunity, holding people responsible for the violations, is needed for there to be a long-lasting peace and for there to be justice. And of course, it is extremely important for the victims of these violations.
Thanks for that. Anthony, can you speak just briefly about the importance of having independent reporting in Syria moving forward?
I think that clearly what we are seeing, in addition to a brutal attempt to suppress an uprising, is an equally brutal attempt to eliminate any form of independent reporting about what is going on in Syria right now, about the atrocities that are being committed there, about the onslaught. And we're seeing that in terms of the refusal to grant virtually any foreign reporters access to the country, the efforts to channel the reporting of those handful that are allowed into the country, brutal suppression of any attempts by Syrian journalists, including citizen journalists, to report on the uprising. And so in that context, I think it's even more important to continue that dogged attempt to document things independently.
Okay, thank you so much. We've come to the end of this week's edition of Global Journalist, produced by the Reynolds Journalism Institute by the Missouri School of Journalism. Joining us today were Ule Solvang from Human Rights Watch and Anthony Mills of International Press Institute. Thank you for providing a fascinating perspective on the crisis in Syria, and I hope that your work helps the journalists and helps people get this information.
Thank you.
And Global Journalist is directed by Travis McMillan, audio by Pat Akers, and Raymond Tungakar is our executive producer. Now stay tuned for Free Press Watch and join us again next week for another Global Journalist. I'm David Reed.
And now, Free Press Watch, a segment on Global Journalist where each week we bring you a rundown of major events affecting press freedom around the world. I'm Lainey Mullen. Today's news comes from the BBC, the Committee to Protect Journalists, and Reporters Without Borders. Last month in Iran, at least 10 journalists were jailed. The increase in arrests served to intimidate other journalists before parliamentary elections in March. Persian relatives of BBC staff have also been harassed and detained. This week in Ecuador, two journalists were found guilty of defamation and ordered to pay President Rafael Correa $1 million each. The journalists had published a book revealing that the president's brother held $600 million worth of state contracts. The contracts were canceled, but the president sued, continuing his pattern of using lawsuits to discourage critical journalists. In Russia, demonstrators are making an impact on mainstream media. Television stations NTV and Первый канал have started airing dissident voices, even at peak viewing times. Journalists, though, still face risks. Last week, the offices of an opposition party weekly were firebombed. No one was injured, but records and property were destroyed. Motivation for the early morning attack was not known. For more information on these and other events affecting press freedom around the world, please visit our website at globaljournalist.org. Thank you for joining us this week on Global Journalist. I'm Lainey Mullen. See you next week.